Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Our Radio EcoShock coverage of the Durban Climate Conference continues. With a long-distance call to Africa, we talk with Janet Redman. She knows the ropes of international negotiations, the activist scene, and politics back home in Washington. The Durban Conference is over. Was it enough to stave off climate disaster? I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Reporting from South Africa, our guest is Janet Redman. She is co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Janet attended the 17th Conference of the Parties, known as COP17. That United Nations Climate Conference wrapped up a day and a half late in the wee hours of December 11th, 2011. Janet, you must be exhausted. And is exhaustion a good state of mind for delegates to decide the fate of the world?
So thanks for having me on, Alex. I am indeed exhausted. We just all kind of rose up from a nap. The negotiations went until 6 o'clock this morning, which was a day and a half actually past what they were supposed to go. So as you can imagine, delegates are working late into the night, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night. And in fact, this is how the trajectory of the COP often works. There are often people making decisions about the fate of the world on, 2 hours of sleep and many cups of coffee. In fact, it was really interesting, about 11:30 last night, Venezuela, who's often been the voice of reason, surprisingly, in these talks, stood up, demanded to be recognized, in fact, jumped on the table waving her placard until she was recognized, and made a statement about how even though folks are tired, exhausted, it's important not to take a bad deal here at the COP because the planet will be feeling much worse. Even if we're exhausted now, the planet will be feeling worse if we make a bad deal in Durban.
What was the main thrust of the agreement reached?
There are three pieces of it, actually. I mean, when we came to Durban, the world really had to solve two big problems. One, of course, tackling greenhouse gas emissions, the pollution that brings us climate change. And two, providing finance to developing countries who are most impacted by climate change, by global warming, and who have the least capacity, least resources to deal with the impacts and to move off of dirty development pathways to clean energy pathways. So both emissions and finance were really on the table. What we got was a little disappointing, actually. The main treaty that regulates emissions internationally, called the Kyoto Protocol, was continued for a certain commitment period, but basically it's an empty shell. It has no legally binding structure. The pledges that are included in that, the emissions that countries promised to keep, were only taken note of. They weren't decided upon or approved. And we were able to get a global climate fund and put some meat on the bones of the global climate fund here. But again, because there were no decisions taken about provision of long-term climate finance, it's also at this point just an empty shell. What was very worrying, I think, and will be worrying over the next years, is that something called a new mandate was launched here in Durban. Basically, it's a deal to plan, to talk some more about solving the problem over the next 5 to 10 years. And it erases the difference between rich and poor countries. It brings the bigger emerging developing countries on par, in a sense, with those who've been historically responsible for the climate change problem, and moves away from a legally binding structure to what we call a pledge and review structure. Basically, you decide what you can do, you put that number on the table, we come back later and see if you've done it. It doesn't get us to the kind of emissions reductions that scientists say we need to stave off climate catastrophe.
Yes, a new treaty will be negotiated by 2015, and that won't come into force until 2020. Doesn't that give the whole world a free-for-all of dangerous emissions for the next 8 years?
It's really unnerving. And in fact, even those dates, if you look at some of the final texts, were in a sense bracketed. So what's really unnerving is that we've seen, in fact, last year, between 2009 and 2010, we saw the biggest rise in emissions globally, 6%, that's record-setting. So what this means is that we've, again, promised to talk about the problem, but not really committed to solving the problem. What we needed to have happen in Durban was a real commitment to a legally binding second commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol, and then thinking about how we're going to move forward to include other big economies. Certainly China is a major polluter. It's the single largest greenhouse gas emitter on the planet right now. But it's important to look inside those countries, look inside the United States, and see that, in fact, their per capita greenhouse gas footprint is about 10 times the size of many of the emerging economies. Again, India, which is becoming a major emitter, has 900 million people above and beyond our population in the U.S. They're both countries, China, India, Brazil, Indonesia, who are now considered major economies and major emitters, are countries that are also majorly struggling with poverty. And so the fact that developed countries won, in a sense, putting off a discussion of their own commitments to make sure they capture these other economies, means that we're going to see, I think, a huge rise in emissions over the next years, and a pushing off of solving the problem that really we're entering crisis mode right now. It's a real disappointment.
Janet Redmond, you know the Washington scene. How much of the struggle about legal commitments do you think was tailored to the deadlock and denial in American politics?
I think it's responsible for a huge amount of the dynamic in the negotiations, and it's been responsible for that dynamic for many years. I mean, the fact that the U.S. came to the negotiating table in 1997, was negotiating for the Kyoto Protocol, was putting terms and conditions on the table, that meant that many countries gave up and crossed their own red lines. Ultimately, the United States was able to change something called the Clean Development Fund, where countries would pay a fee if they were to break or not meet their legally binding emissions reductions. They were able to get that switch to a clean development mechanism, which basically allowed countries to put money to use this carbon trading, carbon offsetting mechanism to outsource their emissions cuts responsibilities to developing countries. And that was supposed to be used as a source of funding as opposed to a fund itself. At the end of the day, after winning this new mechanism, they decided not to ratify anyway. The story hasn't changed much in the years since. The U.S. is constantly blocking progress on conversations that are important to many countries around the globe, and ultimately being an obstructor of many conversations here in the lead-up to Durban. They were blocking the Green Climate Fund. They were blocking on long-term finance. They've long said they will never join the Kyoto Protocol. And they've really sparked off a kind of I won't go first if you won't go first conversation with China, which means that no one moves first. I think what's remarkable is that most folks, not surprisingly, are very aware of American politics and are very aware of the fact that our Congress will not let anything move forward. And I think are growing aware of the fact that Obama is not, in fact, the climate president, the environmental president that he said he was. I think folks were pretty conscious of the fact that not only is this not going to be an election issue for Obama, he's going to distance himself from climate change and environmental issues as he moves into this election cycle. So the fact that the U.S. can't deliver anything is pretty clear, yet countries still, in many ways, cater to the U.S. because they really control a large amount of the politics that happen inside the negotiations.
And Canada was expected to be a spoiler, trying to prop up the dirty tar sands oil projects. What did you see or hear about that?
Canada made some really shocking moves there. Earlier in the conversation, in the first week, rumors were flying around that Canada was saying it was actually going to remove itself from the Kyoto Protocol, break the treaty, and not finish out its commitment through 2012. So, again, the first commitment period of the Kyoto Protocol went from 2005 to 2012, and countries who signed that treaty were going to reduce emissions by about 5% total between all developed countries minus the U.S. by 2012, at which point then in January 1st, 2013, the second commitment period would be started. Canada said last year very clearly they weren't going to be part of the second commitment period unless other major emitters came along. But surprisingly, this year they said, we're just going to pull out of the treaty altogether and not even make our 2012 targets. I think a lot of people were speculating about whether, that really comes by the fact that by exploiting the tar sands, they're going to miss their targets anyway, and it would be better PR to pull out now when everyone's making moves to abandon the Kyoto Protocol than to find themselves at the end of 2012 not in compliance with their legal treaty. I think ultimately everyone came on board with this idea of a new mandate and a commitment period to the Kyoto Protocol, in part because it's so weak that it almost doesn't matter if you sign on, because basically you can pledge whatever you want and there's no legal mechanism for ensuring that you reach those targets by the end of the commitment period.
Well, Canada disregarded the treaty anyway. They're 29% over the promised emissions reduction, so that never happened. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Janet Redmond from the Institute for Policy Studies based in Washington, D.C. Janet attended the 17th Conference of the Parties, the climate talks at Durban, South Africa. China is now the world's largest single source of greenhouse gas emissions. Janet, give us your impression of China's role at the Durban talks.
I think China is interesting. China's in many ways kind of the great-grandfather of a group of developing countries called the G77 plus China. That's 133 developing countries that are represented by one negotiating bloc, and China is certainly the heavy hitter of that group. Many of the small island developing states have kind of moral authority in that space. India certainly has authority because of its size and its economic weight. But China really is the leader of that bloc and in some ways sets the policy for the rest of the G77 bloc. I think in many ways, kind of is scapegoated by many countries, particularly developed countries and sometimes developing countries as well, again, because their emissions are so high. But I think what's really important to look at in China's role is that, again, we measure pollution in a really interesting way in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. We don't look at who's actually the beneficiary of the carbon emissions that go into the atmosphere. So if you look at carbon emissions and you look at where the products that are consumed go, you would see that the majority of China's emissions are actually the consumption emissions of folks like the United States. In fact, that would be the main importer of Chinese goods. You know, China has a funny role. They're both trying to play heavy with the United States. There, many countries rely upon them to kind of bring a counterweight to the U.S. But at the same time, they're also, you know, they're also a still developing country. They're also dealing with their own poverty and their own call for the right to develop. So I think the role that they play very specifically is to call attention to this idea of carbon budgeting and atmospheric space and the right to atmospheric space. Listeners may have heard of the concept of climate debt, and that's the idea that folks in the global north, countries in the global north, who've been most responsible for the historical emissions of greenhouse gases, both need to reduce their own emissions drastically, but to make space for countries like China to develop and bring basic electricity services to their people, but also provide finance in terms of money to help support a clean energy revolution, really, in countries like China. You know, China's really been on the front edge of making that case that we need to have atmospheric space to develop. At the same time, China is leading in renewable energy, particularly in wind. I think it's really important to note that when China had ag moved to subsidize their renewable energy sector, unions in the U.S. moved to sue them, and in fact, the U.S. government is going to be taken into international court because of their moves to subsidize their renewable energy sector.
America should be doing that.
Absolutely. It's really shocking that you hear over and over again the U.S. saying other countries aren't doing enough. Yet when countries move to make, you know, real changes in terms of their policy, the U.S. reacts. So not only has the U.S. begun a suit against China for subsidizing their renewable energy sector, they've also rejected a proposal from the EU around taxing fuels. The EU has passed a new piece of legislation regulating aviation fuels. It creates a small levy on aviation fuel that air traffic from and to any part of the European Union will have to pay. The U.S. Congress passed a law recently saying that we should break that law, and in fact, U.S. airlines should not pay that tax. And that's remarkable. That's a pretty special Congress in terms of disregard for international multilateralism in general and basically anything that's not American stamped. I think it's particularly egregious when the law we're asking American companies to break is one that's meant to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, tell us about what happened outside the meetings. What happened with the NGOs and the protests? Was there some activity and action there?
Yeah, you know, the one thing that we're seeing over and over again since Copenhagen, when civil society really made incredible use of the space both inside and outside the negotiating hall to make their demands heard, to support the interests, I think, of the most impacted communities, the poorest communities. We've seen a real shutting down of the civil society space inside the negotiations. And so increasingly, in particular this year, there were very few actions. There were very few, you know, eruptions of trash actions or demonstrations. There was something called the Speaker's Corner outside, which actually calls onto a legacy of Durban activism during apartheid, a space that was occupied basically the entire 2 weeks of activities and speakers and teach-ins that was really vibrant and really active and very exciting. But it wasn't really until the last day when people were fed up with having their voices crushed inside that people decided to occupy inside the cot, inside the negotiating halls. And you may have seen coverage from this. There were probably about 300 people that flooded the hallway demanding that negotiators don't kill Africa, keep the World Bank out of climate finance, no dirty treaty. A number of calls that really spontaneously came from people who were in that crowd, from all over the world, really, from people that are following the policy, but also people that were there from movements that are most impacted by climate change, people from low lying island states, people who are impacted by the increasing indebtedness from institutions like the World Bank, many, many youth. It was a really moving experience, actually, and people who were saying, civil society really needs to take this conversation back up. I think it points increasingly to the fact that it's important, I really think it's very important for a UN process to treat global warming because, in fact, it is a global problem that crosses borders. But increasingly, we need to make sure we're not depending on UN processes to solve this problem for us. It has to be about people solving the problem in their own communities, holding their national governments accountable, and then making sure that their governments are acting like fair players in the international arena as well.
I couldn't agree more. Were there some positive developments, do you think, at Durban?
I think there were some positive developments. I would say that whenever there's a COP held in a particular location, there's an incredible amount of organizing that goes into bringing civil society together in those specific geographic locations. So I think one of the most exciting outcomes of this COP were the outside, the outside results, and one was that African civil society really came together around the concept of climate change and the impacts and demanding basically reparations for climate change. There was a caravan that moved throughout Africa organized by the Pan-African Climate Justice Alliance that brought many people together and held events in multiple countries, and that was really exciting. I also thought that one of the most exciting outcomes was that the Occupy movement and the climate justice movement started finding links together and speaking in one voice, talking about how what's happening in global warming is really a manifestation of this broken economic system, and it's really all about inequality. And that was, I think, a really important message for people to get who are both policy wonks and are looking at the, you know, minutia of these talks, but also important for people in the larger economic justice movement as well. I think in terms of inside politics, probably the best thing we got was a movement forward on this Green Climate Fund, and in some ways, the weakening of the World Bank's hold on climate finance is astonishing. We kind of almost think in these talks that at the end of the day, the World Bank will win whatever they want. And certainly they're moving forward in many fora, in terms of carbon markets, bilateral finance, et cetera. I think it was a bit of a win to see that the World Bank is not going to be basically controlling the Green Climate Fund for now. Of course, we have to work hard on that for the next year to make sure that it's concretized by the end of the next COP. And they'll be making more decisions about that fund.
As we wrap up, what about your personal experience at COP17? Would you do it again? And how do you feel personally about the outcome?
I'm feeling not surprised, but slightly disappointed. I had kind of thought that potentially countries would rally, given the circumstances that we're seeing around the world, given that people are coming from all over the planet and are seeing impacts locally in every one of their countries. I thought there would actually be the political will when push came to shove to, you know, bring a second commitment period to the Kyoto Protocol. There's stuff I don't like about it, and I think in particular the whole carbon trading regime is incredibly dangerous. But lack of political will from our global leaders means that if I have kids someday, they're probably going to be living in a place that's wreaked with storms and floods, and basically their future is looking unstable, ecologically unstable. And that's pretty depressing, actually, as someone who works on this issue day in and day out. It makes me think about the other ways that I need to organize, you know, do more local activism and more domestic activism, and maybe point this energy in the direction of these international conferences. Hope that people from the local area, you know, will be engaged in local activism around the COP.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Janet Redmond. She is co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. We reached her just after the United Nations COP17 Climate Conference at Durban. Janet, thank you so much for talking with us and for suffering through those endless hours of climate talks.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me on.
This is Radio EcoShock. I am your host, Alex Smith. Now on to Australia to get the latest on climate science and our ever-rising greenhouse gas emissions. We have Michael Ropak on the line from Adelaide. He's the longtime science leader, researcher, and fellow of CSIRO. That is the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization. It is Australia's national science agency. Dr. Ropak, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Pleasure, Alex.
Well, back in 2006, you warned the amount of carbon dioxide produced by humans was on the rise. We've just seen that confirmed with another huge increase in 2010. For all the conferences and studies and reports, when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions, it seems like we're just going backwards, aren't we?
Well, we're going backwards in the sense that emissions continue to increase. Total emissions from the combination of fossil fuels and land use change over the last two centuries have increased by about 1.9% per year. And that rate has gone up over the last decade or so to an increase of around 3% per year. And through the last decade, we've seen some fluctuations around that rate. For instance, in 2009, there was a drop in emissions of about just over a percentage. But then in 2010, we lost all that gain because emissions went up by a very large amount, nearly 6%. So averaged over the decade, we're still climbing round about 3% per year, faster than the long-term historic rate, and consistent with, if it continues, with significant climate change problems within two or three decades.
You also said that sinks, the places that help trap our carbon emissions, may be weakening. Please tell us about that.
Well, weakening sinks is sometimes misunderstood. The sinks themselves, these are the land and ocean processes that naturally remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere when there's excess CO2 in the air, as there is now, of course, as a result of all these human-induced emissions. And those sinks, over the last 50 years, have taken out about 55% of all the CO2 that's been put into the atmosphere by humans. That's a huge amount. It's a huge ecosystem service, a service that nature is performing on our behalf, because if that CO2 was not removed from the atmosphere in that way, then we'd have more than twice the challenge in reducing emissions that we now do. Now, what's been happening over the last few years is that that number of 55%, that's been the average amount removed through the last 50-odd years, has been slowly reducing. It fluctuates a lot from year to year, so it's difficult to say what it was this year relative to the 55%. But the trend over those 50 years has seen that amount decrease by maybe one-fifth.
By about 20%.
So a decline in sinks of about a fifth means that the sink rate has declined from, if you will, something like 60% to something like 50%. There's enormous fluctuation from year to year. Sometimes it's a good deal less than 50%, sometimes very much more than 50%. But on average, we are seeing this slow, steady weakening in the fraction of the CO2 that is being removed from the atmosphere by these natural sinks.
So when we think about the amount of carbon we have left to burn before we go over the top into some crazy climate change, we have to keep in mind that as we progress, nature is able to take up less and less of it.
That's absolutely right.
Is the Global Carbon Project still active?
Very much. The Global Carbon Project, as we speak, will be releasing the Global Carbon Budget for the year 2010. That will occur through a letter in Nature Climate Change, which will give the main numbers. And highlight of that release, there'll be two highlights, one being a significant increase in emissions in the last year, that this very strong upturn in emissions following the small downturn in the global financial, attributed to the global financial crisis. The other highlight will be an assessment not just of the production-based emissions by country, but also of consumption-based emissions, and looking at emissions from a consumption viewpoint as opposed to production viewpoint raises the emissions in developed countries substantially by the order of a quarter, and reduces the emissions in the developing countries by a similar amount because of the flow of embodied carbon in traded products, largely from developing countries to developed countries.
In climate research circles in Australia, what is on the top of the menu? What are the imperatives for Australia?
Well, you've asked about research. The question, of course, arises for both research and for policy. But if we just focus on research for a moment, the issue of how rainfall will respond to climate is right on top of people's minds, and it's scientifically a very difficult issue. Rainfall and changes in rainfall are among the hardest things to predict as climate change occurs. The warming trends can be predicted with great confidence. Changes in extremes can be predicted, in temperature, can be predicted with quite good confidence. It's kind of obvious that as average temperatures go up, so the extremes will become much more prevalent, and just a little bit of work with the distributions of the extremes shows that they become very much more prevalent, you know, many more heat waves, many more of the impacts that arise as a result of heat waves, bushfires, heat-related deaths in cities and so forth. These are among the easier predictions. Rainfall is among the harder of the predictions, and there's a lot of work in Australia going on. You mentioned a moment ago the drying trends that are occurring in mid latitudes. Those trends are now increasingly being certainly observed and also attributed to changes in global circulation patterns. One of the ones that's occurring over southern Australia, where I live, concerns something called the subtropical ridge, which is basically the belt of high pressure that runs around the Earth in both latitude in both hemispheres at mid-latitudes, in a latitude around about 35 degrees, which is very close to where I'm sitting now in the southern hemisphere. But one of the consequences of climate change is thought to be that the subtropical ridge will intensify and move further south in the southern hemisphere, move polewards in both hemispheres. Those trends in the latitude where I am, in southern Australia, will result in fewer cold fronts crossing southern Australia. Over the long term, less rainfall, particularly in winter, and therefore reductions in rainfall and reductions in crop yield for crops which are not supplied by irrigation water. Balancing that, there are projections for increased rainfall in the tropics, and those include northern Australia. And it's possible, although highly uncertain, that some of the events that have been seen in northern Australia over the last few years, including, for instance, Cyclone Yasi, events like that, the Queensland floods, have a climate change signal built into them.
Is the Global Carbon Project still active?
Very much. The Global Carbon Project, as we speak, will be releasing the global carbon budget for the year 2010. That will occur through a letter in Nature Climate Change, which will give the main numbers. And the highlight of that release, there'll be two highlights, one being a significant increase in emissions in the last year, that this very strong upturn in emissions following the small downturn in the global financial, attributed to the global financial crisis. The other highlight will be an assessment not just of the production-based emissions by country, but also of consumption-based emissions, and looking at emissions from a consumption viewpoint as opposed to a production viewpoint raises the emissions in developed countries substantially by the order of a quarter and reduces the emissions in the developing countries by a similar amount, because of the flow of embodied carbon in traded products, largely from developing countries to developed countries.
We have been talking with Dr. Michael Ropak, researcher and fellow of CSIRO, the Australian National Science Agency. Michael, thank you so much for sharing your time and this insight.
Pleasure, Alex.
There you go, a full serving of science, doom, and the human circus. We don't have time to cover the simultaneous meltdown of the European Union. Check out our blog at ecoshock.info for links to that shocking news. After the politicians at Durban showed they are not willing to act to save the climate, maybe a fast, deep economic crash is our only hope of maintaining a livable climate for ourselves and for our grandchildren. With that happy thought, I thank you for listening. Download Radio EcoShock programs free from our website, ecoshock.org. You can find my blog and videos there as well. I'm Alex Smith saying, remember, these are the good old days. Enjoy your holiday.